This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The pitchers and catchers report today for spring training, and that means opening day is getting closer. To help get us in that baseball spirit, some little-known baseball history as we go back in time to 1913.
Professional League Baseball had finally come to Covington, Kentucky. And fittingly, the first batter to ever appear in a game was Newport native and St. Louis captain Jimmy Barton. And Covington native Abe Thos, formerly of the Bluegrass League, drove in the first Blue Sox run with a single, scoring Decker. Blue Sox pitcher Walter Justice was simply outstanding, scattering six hits and throwing a complete game shutout. But the star of the game was James Emery, who in the ninth inning, with the bases loaded, made a diving snag at second base and threw to first for a game-ending double play. Opening day in Covington was a smashing success, as more than 6,000 people crammed into Federal Park, spilling onto the field, as the Blue Sox shut out St. Louis 4-0.
That's from Our True Blues, the story of the Covington Blue Sox. Joining us to share the story of the Covington Blue Sox are Kenton County Public Library Adult Services Coordinator John Graham, filmmaker Cam Miller, who produced the documentary about the Blue Sox, and WVXU political reporter and resident baseball expert Howard Wilkinson. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Cam, John, and Howard, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Absolutely. Thank you. Great to be here.
Who were the Covington Blue Sox? I mean, I love baseball, but this is the first I've heard of these guys.
The Covington Blue Sox were a Federal League team in 1913. They decided, the powers that be, wanted a new league, and Covington happened to be approved of a team. And it went through some bickering in the early days. I mean, you got to think, this started in, like, February, and then the team started playing in May. So you had a league forming and games starting in May. It's just incredible to think about these days. That's almost impossible. Can't imagine doing it. But they were a Federal League team. It didn't last long, but Covington did have a professional team.
How long did they last, Cam?
A couple months. Two months.
Yeah. So what happened? Did they move off to another city?
They moved
to
Kansas City, became the Packers. And interestingly enough, the Packers, the Kansas City Packers of the Federal League, became they actually opened up Wrigley Field in Chicago for the very first game. So it could have been the Covington Blue Sox opening up Wrigley Field.
That's amazing. But, you know, one of the most interesting things that you discovered was just how quickly they had to put a ballpark together.
It's unbelievable. I mean,
and
amazing.
And what they did and on this little tiny postage stamp of a piece of real estate.
Well, let's play some more from the documentary.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about this because this piece deals specifically with the creation of the ballpark.
The Covington Blue Sox home opener was scheduled for May 9th, which left the contractors only weeks to complete the ballpark. Workers even strung up lights so they could work 24 hours a day. The blueprints called for seating for approximately 6,000 fans, with a grandstand, bleachers, and a standing room platform. The $9,000 ballpark was one of the smallest ballparks ever built for professional baseball. With dimensions of 194 down the right field line, 267 to center, and 218 to left. The Lavelle and Buffington Tobacco Company warehouse was in right and center fields, and in front was a 15-foot wide alley. A scoreboard was erected in center field and was viewable from all parts of the ballpark. Federal Park was built in a mere 24 days, a testament to the will, determination, and pride of the people of Covington, Kentucky.
Cam, if you go over to Covington today, where should I stand to be in the middle of at the pitcher's mound, say?
Right across from the Ascent in that parking lot there where the parking garage is
right.
For the courthouse right there. If you go to parking spot 88, that is approximately where home plate was.
Yeah.
So if you stand there and look towards the Ascent, and you can imagine where that tobacco warehouse was right there where the parking garage is.
Right.
And you can just see how amazing the shortness of the distance from home plate to the wall is absolutely incredible.
Well, that warehouse was up for many, many years.
Right.
It was only in the, 1990s that it came down? Or?
Yeah, and then just the lot. I mean, they had a tobacco warehouse there for, I want to say 20 years. Yeah. The park was torn down in 1919. And then another warehouse, tobacco warehouse, went right there. And they tore that down. It was just an open lot. But that, you're right, that was Kentucky Auto Parts. Many, many businesses went in there over the years. But you're right, the 1990s, it finally came crashing
down. And you're what, a block or two from the riverfront?
Right.
Okay, I mean, so
you're
what's right the view the across the river? What are you seeing on the Cincinnati side?
You're seeing the, the Central Trust Tower would have been there, and you're seeing the bridge. I mean, can you imagine the view if you're out there sitting on a fence in right field, and you're just looking over, and you could see such a tremendous view of Cincinnati?
John, what amazes me when I heard that is the size of the ballpark, the dimensions. What was it? Right field's 194 feet?
Yeah, it's incredibly small. And the point that Cam made in his film is you have sometimes you'd hit the ball over the fence. It would actually count as a ground rule double. But, you know, the even more remarkable part about building this park is any kind of riverfront story is a flood story. And right before they started work on the park was a big 1913 flood. Mm-hmm. We don't remember that as much because of 1937, of course. So they're fighting all these flood-torn areas in addition of everything else to get this park built in less than 4 weeks.
Right.
And then what were the other dimensions? It was
267 to center.
267 to center.
218 to left.
Now, yeah. In 1912.
That's a dead ball era, though, isn't it, Howard?
Well, it's right. It was a dead ball era, but, you know, you could still hit a ball out of the park.
Right.
And just across the river in 1912, Redland Field opened, which later became Crosley Field, which is where the Reds played, of course. The dimensions of Redland Field in 1912 were 360 feet down both the left and right field lines and 420 feet to dead center field. So you could essentially put two...
Right, if you hit a ball to second base at Redland Field, that would have been a home run.
Right, exactly. I mean, you could almost stick two of the ballparks.
It's really unbelievable to
into
think about.
Redland Field.
But they're using these really, really hard balls back then. They're nothing like the balls they play with today.
Well, yeah, they didn't have a cork center. Basically, I mean, that was the major difference. That dead ball era lasted until about 1920, when this big fellow by the name of Ruth. Set a record in the dead ball era with 29 home runs.
Right.
And they scratch their heads and say, maybe people will come pay to see people hit baseballs out of a ballpark. And they did.
Right. Well, what's fascinating is there was only one home run hit in Federal Park.
And that
in the 2 months they were there, because, like you said before,
despite
they were
the small dimensions.
Right. Okay. You would think people would say, oh, there must have been 50 home runs a game. Well, actually, no, it was a double if it went over the fence. But there was one home run on May 13th. A gentleman hit it off of they were 10 fences. Mm-hmm. So it hit off the 10 and bounced back and rattled around. By the time the left fielder got the ball, the gentleman, Mr. Emery, circled the bases, and it was inside the park home run, the only home run hit at Federal Park.
John, how much interest are you seeing from people at the Covington Library in this aspect of baseball history?
You know, Mark, that's a great question, because we're seeing this stuff really grow. 1913, like Cam said, was the first year, the first season for the Federal League and the Blue Sox. And then a former coworker of mine, Luke Groshen, and I used the resources, the newspapers at the library, to gather a lot of the information together about the Blue Sox and do some programs. And then that sort of sparked interest for people. And then with Covington's bicentennial, 2015, that also spurred some interest with this, with publications and things like that. And you mentioned Walter Justice. We heard his name, Walter Smoke Justice. That name may sound familiar to folks, because there's a Smoke Justice sports bar that just opened on Court Street in Covington, and it's entirely based with decor on the Blue Sox. So this, it's coming to the surface from a few years ago. People would not have heard about this. Maybe baseball aficionados heard of the Federal League. That's about it. So the Covington portion is really coming up to the surface, which is awesome.
Yeah, Cam, when you came across this and decided to look into it and ultimately do a film about it, you had very little to go on. In terms of memorabilia, nothing.
Nothing.
No baseballs, no uniforms, no...
Nothing at all.
No,
I had
programs.
Four photos. And luckily, John and his fantastic library had their microfilm machines that I would sit... I started this in 1998. and the old printouts. Remember the old printers?
Yes, I do, yes.
And I would get all these articles printed out because nothing was digitized.
Absolutely.
So I would get all these printouts, and I would, of course, shove in probably hundreds of dollars a week and quarters and dimes just to get these. And articles is all I had, and a few photos, and the quality wasn't the greatest. So in my film, I had to get really creative. I had to design the ballpark. I had to reimagine this ballpark. I had to redesign what some of the players might have looked. We didn't know. So that was really – that was an interesting way to do it. I'd never done a film like this before.
Did they have box scores in those things?
Yeah. I've collected every box score of the Blue Sox, which wasn't hard considering
yeah,
they were only around 2 months. But I got them all, and then a few pictures that I did find that were published in the Kentucky Times Star and the Kentucky Post.
When you started on this, Cam, did you think you were going to have enough material to put together a full-length documentary?
Absolutely not. I originally thought this would be good for somebody to write an article. I'll pass it on to my good buddy John Arardi or something, and he'll do an article on it. But then I started saying, you know what? I'm a filmmaker. I'm going to make this into a film. I'm going to figure out a way to do it. And it took a long time, but I got it. And luckily enough, we had the great premiere at the Kenton County Library. You know, just a great crowd, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was awesome. Mm-hmm.
Did I hear that right? It took 24 days?
24 days
to build the ballpark?
Yes.
That's
really
fascinating. Unbelievable.
And they had people that they'd string up lights to work around the clock, and they would also have people would get off work, volunteers that would work down the rolling mill in Newport would come over with their hammers and help them. I mean, just the tremendous pride that the city took for this team. It was unbelievable.
And then $9,000.
Yeah.
For the whole thing.
For the whole thing. Right. 24 days, $9,000.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah. $9,000 probably pays for a section of the grass at Great American Ballpark,
right.
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
So,
Who were some of the notable players? We talked earlier about one. Who were some of the other players from the Blue Sox team?
Well, there was – the only Covington native was Ade Thos, and the rest of them were just journeyman minor leaguers. There was really no notable – the manager was Sam Lever, and he actually pitched in the first World Series ever for Pittsburgh. And another manager in the Federal League for Cleveland was Cy Young. So you had some pretty big names coming into Covington during that time. And in fact, the Covington brass wanted Ty Cobb to manage the team. They sent him a telegram and said, hey – we want Ty Cobb. And, of course, Ty Cobb said, thanks, but no thanks. I've got other fish to fry. But it's unfortunate because you can imagine if Ty Cobb did manage, it would have probably given this team a little bit more notoriety.
Yeah, they would have been around, I think, for longer than just a month.
Right.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you would like to join us. And what about the okay, so eventually they moved to Kansas City, you said? Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And they morphed into this other team. And it does make you wonder what would have happened if they had stuck around longer. I mean, would that have even worked? Because I think there was a rule that you couldn't have two professional teams
right.
within a certain distance
the
of each other.
The 5-mile clause, really. I mean, Covington is such a hotbed for baseball. It's not as much today as it used to be, but you have to really – if you look at it, you can see so many players that came from Northern Kentucky, and particularly Covington. It was just a hotbed for baseball, and they were just crazy about it. But, you know, unfortunately, the league, the 5-mile clause was in effect. You really couldn't have – that's why it wasn't a major league team. It was a federal league team. That's why the federal league came, so they could put teams in cities where they thought, you know, they could do some damage. So, yeah, it's just unfortunate. It really is. They couldn't last much longer than they did.
Yeah.
Well, and the league went 2 more years. So the federal league, of course, went 1913 right. through 1915. So by 1914, when our team was in Kansas City, the league declared itself a major league. And they expanded to 8 teams. And then for those baseball aficionados out there, for the Federal League's final 2 seasons, you know, 1914 and 15, that was considered major league statistics and major league service because they found enough current, former, and future major league players to make it count. And you asked about names. The name that I bring up, which is not a Covington name but a federal league name, is Ed Rausch.
Yeah.
Real popular player for the Reds who started his career
Hall
in the Federal
Famer.
League. Hall of Famer for sure. And that's how he got his start in the Federal League. And, you know, those stats count. And that's where he started.
And doing the research, John, what surprised you the most about the history of the Blue Sox?
Well, the thing that surprised me the most, to follow on what Cam said in terms of this incredible enthusiasm, like people pounding nails over, you know, after they got off work, the first game for the Blue Sox home game was May 9th, 1913. 6,000 people were there. In less than a month, the attendance had collapsed, and they're talking like 400, 500, 600 people. And the reason they moved to Kansas City was not some owners trying to get themselves a big stadium deal. You know, they just ran out of fans, ran out of money. And the league was trying to put teams in different spots. So I would say that's most surprising. You go from 6,000 to a few hundred to out of town in less than 2 months.
Right.
Was it just a matter of the novelty wearing off? Or
Absolutely. And you got to remember, there was no bobblehead days or giveaways.
No.
I mean, you had a couple ladies' days like that, but that's exactly right, the novelty. You had opening day. It's such because they had a parade. It was a spectacle. Right. They had pigeons carrying messages to every other league. They had a cannon shoot off these fireworks. It was just an unbelievable atmosphere. But then, you know, some rain. They had a lot of rainouts. They had a lot of – I mean, remember, games are during the day.
Yeah.
People had to work.
Sure.
It was very tough to get to these games. So if the weekend games did the best attendance, obviously. But like you said, John, it was just, it's just so hard.
Did they have overlap between the Reds and the Blue Sox on their game schedules?
Oh, yeah. There would be times where, you know, you'd cram in, you know, the ballpark in Cincinnati, and then you'd get like 50 or 60 people. And you got to remember, Cy Young is in Covington. It's like, you'd think that'd be a draw, but you know, it wasn't a big deal. It's like, it's just...
Famous pitcher like that.
Right.
And the part was, you know, it is Reds country. And like you just mentioned, Howard, the Redland Field opened up the year before. And we can't forget Latonia Racetrack was a big draw. That was major league racing in this part of the state. So there's a lot of factors that go into it.
Yeah. Cam, what was most surprising to you as you were looking into this?
Probably the fact that this was just buried in our history. I mean, Covington really does a great job of bringing out – you know, the history of the town. But when I discovered this, I just thought it was a semi-pro team. And it was almost like it had been forgotten. And it was just sad to me that nobody had really done anything with it. I'm just so glad that people got to see, hey, there was a professional team right down here in the riverfront. And they only lasted 2 months, but you got to remember, this town rallied around this team and it just disappeared as quickly as it came. And like I said before, it was a hotbed of baseball, so it's unfortunate. But I was really stunned. I was really shocked that I never knew this, and most people I talked to didn't know about it. They just knew that it was a little blurb in a newspaper from 1913.
So this is a full-fledged professional team. What were the salaries like for these guys back then?
Oh, they weren't making hardly anything at all. I don't know exactly what they were paid. They didn't really disclose it. But I will tell you an interesting tidbit. It was that Sam Lever, the manager, he put in his contract. He was so confident that he was going to finish in first or second place that he told the owners, if I don't finish in first or second, you can forfeit a portion of my salary. Well, I don't know exactly how that worked out. Can you imagine that today? Can you imagine Brian Price, the Reds fan? You know what? If we don't finish first or second place, you can take half my salary. It didn't work like that. So, yeah, that was interesting, but I don't know what the deal tells
you. I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, you go back to 1869 Red Stockings.
Right.
I've seen their, you know, salary list, and it ranges from like $300 to, you know, maybe $1,100 for the rights.
It's one of the things where I wish I could find a scorebook or some of the business papers.
Right.
Just I had nothing to go on. It's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. So just the visuals I had to design, but just as far as the business side of it, you just kind of had to feel your way through it.
And that's the difference between researching, say, the Reds and something like the Blue Sox, because the records are all there for the most part.
And I do a lot of work for the Reds Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And I have access to so much.
Oh, yeah.
So when I have that, I remember working in the Crosley Field film. I did the Crosley Field film the same time I was finishing the Blue Sox. And I had all these records and these pictures.
Yeah.
And then I'd go to Blue Sox, like, can I just find something? Grab my pencil. Let's start drawing this ballpark.
John, are you expecting anything new to turn up if you keep researching the Blue Sox? Is there anything more that could turn up about them?
That's such a great question. You know, a couple things come to mind. One of them is, and you looked into this, is, you know, the memorabilia that somebody somewhere has got, you know, a uniform or something like that hidden away somewhere. But not so much things as the people is that when we did the premiere at the library and then when the Smoke Justice Place opened up just last year, there are descendants out there of these players. Mm. And a lot of folks may or may not know much about their ancestors. You said Walter Justice's family was contacted and came to the Smoke Justice event. I know at the Covington Library when we did your premiere, we had made an effort to find ancestors of the players and actually found some.
Yeah, there was a couple, and then the architect's grandson was there just to shake his hand was amazing. It was just, and I was at the premiere for Smoke Justice and meeting the Justice family. They were just in awe of what they saw around them, these pictures of their, you know, great-granddad, their grandfather, and I was overwhelmed. It was just amazing to see.
Yeah, but they didn't have any of the memorabilia or
nothing.
That kind of thing.
There is one thing that I want, the Holy Grail. It is a gold baseball that the mayor threw out for the first pitch.
Is that right?
Nobody knows
where that baseball
nobody
is.
Nobody knows where that
it's
is.
It's in some attic somewhere.
It's either in an attic or it's in the bottom of the Ohio River.
And it may or may not be in Covington for all we know.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Well, Cam, John, and Howard, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure.
Kenton County Public Library Adult Services Coordinator John Graham, filmmaker Cam Miller, who produced the documentary about the Blue Sox, and WVXU political reporter and resident baseball expert Howard Wilkinson. A new robot is bringing back the dining experience to the disabled. WVXU's Ann Thompson reports in Focus on Technology.